Lecture 21, Sir Tristram and the Anxiety of Chivalry.
By the time we come to the midsection of Malory's Great Arthuriad, the book of Sir Tristram, King Arthur has already come to power and consolidated an empire whose headquarters is now not Rome but Camelot, the place from which knights set out on adventure and to which they return with their stories, this place of marvels and of memory. From the adventures of Sir Lancelot, we learned that the life of the best knight in the world is not an easy or straightforward one. His challenges, as we heard, are indirect, bizarre, often transgressive. In one hilarious scene, for example, an exhausted Sir Lancelot out on his adventures finds an elegant pavilion, a luxurious, unexpected campsite, and falls fast asleep until he is awakened by kisses and caresses. Suddenly he realizes that those kisses and caresses are coming from someone who has quite a rough beard, and he rears up in homophobic fear. He and the knight who owns the pavilion, who has been awaiting his lady's arrival, are equally shocked by each other. After a swift and easily quelled fight, they make peace. But Lancelot remains, as we learned, the universal object of desire. Those desires produced a great deal less anxiety for the golden native English youth, nephew to King Arthur, Sir Gareth, whose biographical romance, like the story of Silence, is filled with unexpected and relentlessly good fortune. The book of Sir Tristram de Lyonne occupies almost a third of Malory's text. It's a breathtaking aesthetic achievement in which Malory pinpoints the gaps and fissures in the chivalric understanding of personal identity, of love, of friendship, and of happy community. The tale is structured around a series of tournaments that allow Malory to gather huge companies of knights, each of which has a distinct talent, and who often compete with the Arthurian project. The tale of Tristram contains some of medieval literature's most precisely rendered scenes of individual battle, as well as terrifying graphs of emotional pain, terrifying in part because they're so often very funny. In this tale, there are brutally realistic conversations in which chivalric men and women expose the anxiety at the heart of chivalry. We'll only look at some of the episodes in this extraordinary and vast tale. But as we do, we want to see the way that the characters in this story range the vast psychic and physical spaces of Arthurland at large. But they never question their belief that the glittering court of Camelot is the best of all possible worlds until the very end of the tale. Although Arthurian civilization is at its height in the book of Sir Tristram, earlier hints of all sorts of human inadequacies converge here to make us realize that disaster is close at hand. Only when the futility of this failing court life, in spite of its gorgeous and famous tournaments, its rich and rooted loves, and its worldly adventures and quests become apparent at the end, does the Grail quest come into being and become available to the members of this society. So even the failures of the Arthurian project hold the possibility of greater goodness. The Pentecostal oath is often ignored in this tale, replaced by the ad hoc behavior of knights who are driven not by justice or mercy, but by a quest for honor. So we have in this tale a pattern of growth and decay. The Tristram marks the overlapping point in the story between the growth of Camelot and its inevitable failures. In the final preparation we have here for the Grail quest, it shows both the pleasures and lassitudes of a great society as it begins to lose a sense that it has a great and noble purpose. The chief effect of the book is to show the splendor of the Round Table by comparison with the disordered outer world where bright chivalry is known only by reputation and report. I want first just to think about the story of Tristram himself, because the tale opens with the story of the hero's youth and babyhood, even in his childhood. Tristram has a strange ability to incur animosity for reasons entirely beyond his control. His very talents seem to bring anger and loathing towards him, exactly the opposite of the situation that we found with Sir Gareth. His stepmother, for instance, tries unsuccessfully to poison him in order to keep him from his inheritance. But Tristram, in an act that his own father finds entirely unnatural, forgives her. When his uncle King Mark is looking for a champion to defend him for refusing to send tribute to Ireland, as Arthur earlier refused to send tribute to Rome, Tristram proffers himself for the battle with the Irish hero Marhalt. Then Tristram has his uncle King Mark knight him, an act full of ironic implication considering their later hostile relation. Mark's castle is the Castle Tintagel, where Arthur himself was conceived and which Lancelot later rescues. The frequent mention of this stronghold serves to keep the figures of Arthur and his court hovering in the foreground. After Tristram kills Marhalt and receives a terrible wound from his broken sword, he goes to Ireland and assumes a disguise, not as Tristram, but as Tram Trist, in order to have Queen Isolde, who has magical curative powers, help him. When he's told of Marhalt's death, disguise is again in order and necessary, so Sir Tram Trist made semblance as he had been sorry, and better he knew it was than the king, since, of course, he had killed Marhalt himself. At the request of their daughter, the beautiful La Belle Isolde, Tristram takes upon himself another disguise and overcomes Sir Palamedes in tournament. From this point forward, Tristram's adventures himself and the rest of the tale are framed by battles with Sir Palamedes, who is, from the beginning to the end, Tristram's primary opponent and his best friend. When Tristram's real identity is uncovered at the Irish court, in a strange scene that attaches more blame to La Belle Isolde's mother than to Tristram for the deception, Tristram vows to King Anguish of Ireland to be Isolde's knight in all right and in wrong. This is the first mention or admission of this kind of all-consuming relationship to be found in Malory. While Tristram's battle with Sir Marhalt had some good effect, that of freeing Cornwall from truage, the battle with Palamedes was purely gratuitous. When Tristram announces to Anguish his lack of moral concern that he will fight in all right and in wrong, as long as he's able to help Isolde, he is heralding a big change in moral attitudes in the text. The next series of events are framed by Tristram's return to Mark's court. Tristram and King Mark both overtly compete for the attention of Sir Segwarides' wife. Segwarides and Palamedes are brothers. Both Tristram and Mark's love lives involve constant struggles with one or another brother for his wife or mistress. In these circumstances, Tristram and Mark are in the first situation where they both loved one lady. Here the discrepancy between word and deed, appearance and reality in Mark's behavior is suggested, and his great, relentless stupidity becomes comically evident for the first time. He goes off to attack Tristram in the dead of night as Tristram is heading up to visit Sir Segwarides' wife, forgetting that he is visible in his armor by the light of a full moon. Tristram, of course, prevails in this battle, and Mark claims to sympathize with his wounds, never admitting that he himself was the assailant. His attitude of gratitude towards Tristram, however, is now changed. For as long as King Mark lived, he never again loved Sir Tristram. So after that, though there was fair speech, love was there none. The initial mention of Mark's marriage to Isolde is in the context of Mark's vengeance on Sir Tristram. Mark cast all ways that he might destroy Sir Tristram, and he decided to marry Isolde out of vengeance and sends Tristram to fetch her. He does, and on their way back to Mark's court, the two lovers, Tristram and Isolde, drink the love potion. Is it fate? is a choice. Drink the love potion that means that their love comes to full flowering before the marriage with King Mark. Tristram, who is protected to the throne and the lover of the queen, now has positions he's soon called upon to defend. Palamedes at one point rescues Isolde's maiden Brangwen, and when he brings her back to the court, asks for a boon, which is granted, and what he asks for is Isolde herself. This inversion of courtliness and parody of Chrétien's Lancelot gives us a sense that a promise made in what appears to be good faith in this tale will be taken with dark intent. As Isolde says to the Saracen, "You have me at an advantage upon my promise." Tristram soon rescues Isolde, and his growing renown incurs even greater animosity from his jealous uncle Mark. Deciding that he'll defend his own honor, Mark attacks Tristram. And in a funny and terribly degrading scene, when Tristram saw there was none who would be against him, he shook his sword at the king and made a look as if he would strike him. And then King Mark fled, and Sir Tristram followed him and smote him 5 or 6 strokes, flatting on the neck that made him fall on his nose. The scenes that follow further develop the theme of the love affair between Tristram and Isolde and its consequences on Mark's own court. Mark's degradation at Tristram's hand is followed by the attempt of the faithful squire Andred and 12 knights to capture Tristram naked abed with La Belle Isolde. This scene, of course, suggests the later parallel scene of the attempted capture of Lancelot abed with Guinevere. Later, the parallels between the two courts are suggested even more strikingly when Lamorak has a testing horn, which was sent from Morgan le Fay, diverted to King Mark's court rather than be found in Arthur's court. Tristram reproves Lamorak for what he considers an unchivalrous deed, which has impugned the faithfulness, because what's tested is the fidelity of wives, and all the ladies of King Mark's court, including Isolde, failed this test. Lamorak defends his actions. "Well," he said, "and I were to do it again, I would, because I would rather that strife and debate fall in King Mark's court rather than in King Arthur's court, for the honor of both courts is not alike." This is the first explicit comparison of the English and the Cornish courts. And the distinction between them is made not on the basis of virtue, but on the basis of honor. The honor of both courts may not be like, but at this point in the story, we have every occasion to observe that the virtue is essentially the same. The scene is reminiscent of a later device called the adulterous shield, which Tristram ironically himself carries to Arthur's court. Both devices have been manufactured by Morgan le Fay as a way to try to inform her brother Arthur about the Lancelot-Guinevere relationship. And both fall short of their purposes, but it's interesting here that Morgan, always identified previously with forces of evil and disruption, is now dangerous because she threatens to reveal the adulterous situations. In other words, evil has become equated with telling the truth. This speaks about a world far removed from the Pentecostal oath. Parallels between the court of King Mark and the court of Arthur are emphasized. If Cornwall and England are not equal because King Mark of Cornwall is propelled by warped desires that do not include a love of virtue or of high honor that defines King Arthur of England, what this tells us is that Arthur is a king and Mark is a tyrant. But their lives have much in common. Each king has a champion who is his deepest friend, and these champions have remarkable talents. Tristram's are quite different from Lancelot's. We're told Tristram learned to be a harper, passing all others, that there was none such called in any country. And in harping and in instruments of music in his youth, he applied himself to learn. And after, when he growed in might and strength, he labored in hunting and in hawking, never a gentleman more that we heard of. And as the book says, he began good measures of blowing of beasts of venery and beasts of chase and all manner of vermins, and all the terms that we have yet of hawking and of hunting. And the book of venery of hawking and hunting is called the book of Sir Tristram. Wherefore, it seems to me, says Mallory, all gentlemen who bear old arms ought of right to honor Sir Tristram for the good terms that gentlemen have and use and shall do until the day of doom, that thereby in a manner all men of worship may discover a gentleman from a yeoman and a yeoman from a villain. For he who is gentle will draw himself to gentle ways and follow the noble customs of gentlemen. Here we have this notion of Tristram as the one who invents in some ways an idea of courtliness, of learning the terms of hunting, of producing both in music and in dancing, in harping and in making poetry, a form and shapeliness that make even the hunt itself an art as much as a craft. Tristram and Lancelot are the best knights in the world, but Tristram is not a round table knight. But as Lancelot loves Guinevere, Arthur's queen, so too does Tristram love Isolde, who becomes his uncle Mark's queen. Lancelot and Guinevere's restrained behavior, however, is the reverse of Tristram and Isolde. And in this tale, we find a chief device that has been used earlier but now becomes dominant, of disguise, of hidden identity, mistaken identity, confusion, and even ultimately madness. Names often remind us of the ways in which people resemble each other. We have Queen Isolde, the mother, La Belle Isolde, the daughter, and finally, the woman that Tristram marries when he feels expelled from the sight of La Belle Isolde, and her name is itself Isolde of the White Hands. Mallory has shown us in earlier tales how his characters win their identities. In this tale, he shows us how little most people differ from each other, how hard it is to win and keep a distinctive identity. In retrospect, his disguise motif gains full negative force and challenges us as readers to reevaluate all of its earlier and even seemingly amusing uses. So the use of disguise suggests a growing moral confusion in the court. Even so, it's through disguise that some forms of good are achieved. Tristram is cured only because he disguises himself as Tramtrist. In the final section of the tale, Galahad is conceived because his mother disguises herself as Guinevere and thus convinces Lancelot to have sex with her. Galahad is a superb and necessary hero, so disguise here is ambiguous in its results. But Lancelot's disguises in the Tristram are troublesome, since they reveal him almost constantly acting against the principles of the Pentecostal oath. Tristram and Lancelot's ultimate disguises, of course, are as madmen. They lose their identities temporarily, just as they've lost their moral purpose. And in each case, it's because they've been expelled by their beloveds. Isolde sends Tristram away. He goes mad in the forest. Guinevere sends Lancelot away. He goes mad and loses his sense of his own self. Their sense of themselves depends upon their perspective of life as a lover. At one point, Lancelot disguises himself for a tournament in armor in which he appears to be a girl bride, a sign that this culture is badly attenuated, excessively ironized. The basic nature of knightly exchange requires an absolute understanding of identity and a discourse of identity. Disguise and madness prevent this exchange. Chivalry is thus subverted. Parallels between Tristram and Lancelot strengthen our sense of the tale's moral ambiguity. If passion is celebrated, its glories are also shameful. There's one point at which the wonderful knight Uwain refuses to fight Sir Gaheris, because he says they're both round table knights and should not do that. This reminds us that the Pentecostal oath is now observed more in the breach than in the performance. In the Pentecostal oath, love is a form of caritas, a selfless love that requires round table knights to help the needy for the love of their king and of their fellows. The moral certainty reflected by the Pentecostal oath that the right way will be clear is attenuated, therefore, in the book of Tristram. Honor has crept in as a separate value in its own right, and is separated further and further from any idea of justice or mercy. Earlier in a speech that we studied, you'll remember that Lancelot told a damsel that passionate love is inappropriate for knights who perform quests. In the tale of Sir Gareth, love resulting in marriage is righteous. Lust is physically and only temporarily punished. In the tale of Tristram, however, there is no correspondence at all between love on the one hand and moral purpose on the other. The love of Tristram for Isoude and of Lancelot for Guinevere, as seen, it's admirable by their fellow knights in this tale because they are passionate and claim the privileges of secrecy. Thus, lovers require various disguises for their affairs to flourish. The marvelously skeptical Sir Dinadan often scoffs at lovers. From Dinadan's perspective, as one who is not one of the greatest knights in the world, love is itself a madness, leading only, in his case, to physical injury in battle and to emotional humiliation, which is inevitable unless you happen to be one of the greatest knights in the world. Only the greatest knights in the world escape unscathed from any attempt to prove their love and their status as premier knight. This is a serious indictment of a chivalric community. Here knights enter a frenetic search for fame, trying to make the top 10 list of the best knights, which is always and inevitably headed by Tristram on the one hand and by Lancelot on the other. Palamedes, a figure who is prominent in the tale of Sir Tristram, is one of Malory's most interesting characters, and I'd like to concentrate on his story. In Malory, all Saracens except Sir Palamedes are always wrong. Sir Palamedes stirs our interest when he is first mentioned in the tale of King Arthur, not as a Saracen, but as someone we know who will succeed King Pellinore in the questing beast struggle, in pursuit of the questing beast. What we know best about Sir Palamedes, however, is his status as the lone Saracen knight who is always on quest for victory over Sir Tristram, for the love of La Belle Isoude, for the questing beast itself, and for 7 great formal battles, after which he says he will accept baptism. Unchristened at this point in Malory is not a spiritual state, but a chivalric decoration, the prize for winning a questing beast, or La Belle Isoude's heart, or minimally for fighting in 7 great formal battles. And at the end, in lieu of the Grail quest, as the other knights follow it, Sir Palamedes himself merely goes off in search of the questing beast. Placing his pseudo-conversion narrative immediately before all the other knights take the Grail quest allows Malory to show us its spiritual inauthenticity, to concentrate instead on its marker as a chivalric decoration. Sir Palamedes is at the center of a large network of knights who seek worship, and he gratifies the greater value of those knights who win battles from him. But he also retains intimacy with these knights, especially in relation to his friend and peer in worship, Sir Lamorak. Sir Palamedes was first listed as one of the world's great knights in the tale of Sir Gareth, with whom he builds a special relationship. They often disappear on adventures together so that Palamedes and Sir Gareth can avoid Gareth's more troublesome brothers, Gawain, Mordred, Agravain. Malory uses the friendship of Sir Gareth and Sir Palamedes to reinforce their roles not only as alternatives to the vigorous brothers of Sir Gareth, but also because they are special friends to Sir Lancelot. And this intensifies our sense coming of the pivotal moment in which Sir Gareth will die an accidental death by Sir Lancelot's hands. Malory's final mention of Sir Palamedes provides him with a new role. When exiled from England, Sir Lancelot appoints Palamedes, who comes with him, to be the Duke of Provence. These knights in the tale of Sir Tristram perform extraordinary acts of kindness for each other. But on the other hand, they perform extraordinary acts of everyday betrayal. As we know, moral virtue is exchanged for flagrant and easy immorality. The innocent adulterers of the tale of Sir Tristram do not accept adultery as a guilty condition. Knight's lie, Palamedes lies, Lancelot lies. In the costumed world of the tale of Sir Tristram, identity is fractured. Disguise is so common that at one point, Sir Palamedes ups the ante by borrowing his own identity when he disguises himself as the Knight of the Questing Beast. Unlike his beloved and amusing friend Sir Dinadan, who is feminized by his martial and amatory failures, Sir Palamedes never challenges or rejects the reciprocity of reputational exchange, which is at the root of the chivalric enterprise. In this respect, as a crucial participant in all of these martial exploits, his militant masculine status is intact. But he fails in the two great goals of his life, to win La Belle Isoude, or to win real martial victory over Sir Tristram. And these losses subject him to psychic breaks. These psychic breaks are perhaps Malory's most interesting revelations about chivalry in the tale of Sir Tristram. Malory's Palamedes is distinguished by his ability to talk about his own condition. His sense of both his body and his psyche are rendered by Malory with unusual precision. He was cleanly and bigly made, unmaimed of his limbs, neither too young or too old. But his fine body becomes for him a site of loss. He grieves the physical ruination brought to him by his unrequited love of the Belle Isoude. He looks into the well and sees himself discolored and disfated. "Why art thou so defaced," he says to himself, "and ever was wont to be called one of the fairest knights in the world? Forsooth, I will no more live this life for a love that I may never get or ever recover." Palamedes is the most emotionally expressive of Malory's knights. Of all of the knights, he projects the most pure form of Fenimore. His greatest prowess is amplified by the absorbing sight of La Belle Isoude. He fights most fiercely when La Belle Isoude is within view, but even so he loses. Falling into envy and jealousy, he plots deviously, he bonds easily, and weeps copiously. He wailed and wept out of measure, and it was seen upon his cheeks that he had wept full sore. He continuously expresses his anxieties and frustrations. His misery takes him compulsively to a well in the forest where, like a Shakespearean lover and equally often overheard, he rants and shapes his grief. The most literate of Malory's knight, he writes songs and poems, not only about La Belle Isoude, but also about Sir Tristram, whom he admires equally. In spite of his richly expressed anguish about his failures at prowess and passion, Sir Palamedes retains his public dignity except for one pitiful occasion after he has decisively lost the Battle of Lonazep. Receiving no solace after he wails at his well, overwhelmed by grief and envy and shame, he confirms his own impotence by returning to the pavilion where Tristram and Isoude are inside. And he shouts outside the pavilion, "Fie on thee, traitor," to Tristram. And yet inside we know, as the music is too loud for them to hear what's going on outside, Tristram and Isoude are themselves having their dinner, each of them saying, "What's the matter with Sir Palamedes? Why isn't he in here with us?" We have a sense of the difference perception of each of them. Proximity and distance are sources of equal disjunction for Palamedes. When he's with Sir Lancelot, Sir Tristram and La Belle Isoude, we're told he makes the greatest joy among them, but often after that, Sir Palamedes saw La Belle Isoude, the heavier he waxed day by day. Together, he finds a source of joy and loss. Apart, he finds a sense only of loss. With rare exceptions, the orphanage of Arthurian knights find loneliness when they search for each other. With persistent nostalgia, Palamedes mourns the fellowship that never was and might have been. And his discontent and anxiety expose the inescapable hierarchy of the passion-prowess linkage that mars any chivalric project claiming moral excellence as its goal. When we think about this privileged masculine world of sexual amorality, in which we see love is being free and Palamedes constantly pursuing La Belle Isoude, we see him not so much as a lover as a stalker. The clean wind of a simpler world blows through the tale at the end. Elaine, the daughter of Pelles the Grail Keeper, loves and serves Sir Lancelot, and she seduces him when she disguises herself as Guinevere. She is Lancelot's stalker. But her world of warped love produces a child who will relentlessly set things right, just as the Grail will make things whole, as we'll discuss in our next lecture.